Chapter 44. "Do you really expect to get away with it?" Pitt asked. Colonel Ramon Kleist, U.S. Marine Corps, retired, rocked on his heels and scratched an itch on his back with a swagger stick. "So long as we can withdraw as a unit with our casualties, yes, I believe the mission can be pulled off successfully." "Nothing this complicated can go letter perfect," said Pitt. "Destroying the compound and the antenna, plus killing off Velikov and his entire staff, sound to me like you're biting off more than you can chew." "Your eyewitness observation and our stealth aircraft photos corroborate the light defensive measures." "How many men make up your team?" asked Pitt.
31, including yourself."
"The Russians are bound to find out who trashed their secret base. You'll be kicking a hornet's nest."
"All part of the plan," Kleist said airily.
Kleist stood ramrod straight, his chest threatening to burst from a flowered shirt. Pitt guessed his age as mid-40s. He was a medium-skinned black, born in Argentina, the only child of a former SS officer who had fled Germany after the war and the daughter of a Liberian diplomat. Sent to a private school in New York, he decided to drop out and make a career in the Marines.
"I thought there was an unwritten agreement between the CIA and the KGB. We won't waste your agents if you don't waste ours."
The colonel gave Pitt an innocent look. "Whatever gave you the idea, our side will do the dirty work." Pitt did not reply, only stared at Kleist, waiting. "The mission will be conducted by Cuban Special Security Forces," he explained. "They're equivalent to our SEALs. Or, to be honest, expertly trained exiles dressed in genuine Cuban battle fatigues. Even their underwear and socks will be standard Cuban military issue. Weapons, wristwatches, and other equipment will be of Soviet manufacture. And just so we keep up appearances, the landing will come from the Cuban side of the island."
"All neat and tidy."
"We try to be efficient."
"Are you leading the mission?"
Kleist smiled. "No, I'm getting too old to leap out of the surf onto beaches. The assault team will be led by Major Angelo Quintana. You'll meet him at our camp in San Salvador. I'll be standing by on the spot."
"Say again?"
"Special purpose undersea transport," answered Kleist. "A vessel constructed expressly for missions of this kind. Most people don't know they exist. You'll find it most interesting."
"I'm not what you'd call trained for combat."
"Your job is purely to guide the team into the compound and show them the ventilator access to the garage area. Then you're to return to the beach and stay undercover until the mission is completed."
"Do you have a timetable for the raid?"
Kleist had a pained expression. "We prefer to call it a covert operation."
"Sorry, I've never read your bureaucratic manual on semantics."
"In answer to your question, the landing is set for 0200 4 days from now."
"4 days may be too late to save my friends."
Kleist looked genuinely concerned. "We're already working on short notice and cutting our practice exercises razor thin. We need time to cover every uncertainty, every freak event. The plan has to be as airtight as our computer's tactical programs can make it."
"And if there's a human flaw in your plan?"
Any expression of friendly warmth left Kleist's face and was replaced with a cold, hard look. "If there is a human flaw, Mr. Pitt, it is you. Barring divine intervention, the success or failure of this mission will rest heaviest on your shoulders." The CIA people were thorough. Pitt was shuffled from office to office, interview to interview, with stopwatch precision. The plans to neutralize Cayo Santa Maria progressed with prairie fire swiftness. His briefing by Colonel Kleist took place less than 3 hours after he was interrogated by Martin Brogan. He came to realize there were thousands of contingency plans to invade every island in the Caribbean and every nation in Central and South America. Computerized war games created a series of options. All the covert operation experts had to do was select the program that came closest to fitting the objective and then refine it. Pitt endured a thorough physical examination before he was allowed lunch. The physician pronounced him fit, pumped him full of high-potency vitamins, and prescribed an early bedtime before Pitt's drowsy mind turned to mush. A tall, high-cheekboned woman with braided hair was assigned as his nursemaid,
escorting him to the proper room at the proper time. She introduced herself as Alice, no surname, no title. She wore a soft tan suit over a lace blouse. Pitt thought her rather pretty and found himself wondering what she would look like curled up on satin sheets. "Mr. Brogan has arranged for you to eat in the executive dining room," she said in perfect tour guide fashion. "We'll take the elevator." Pitt suddenly remembered something. "I'd like the use of a telephone." "Sorry, not possible." "Mind if I ask why?" "Have you forgotten you're supposed to be dead?" Alice asked matter-of-factly. "One phone call to a friend or a lover, and you could blow the entire operation." "Yes, the slip of a lip may sink a ship," Pitt said cynically. "Look, I need some information from a total stranger. I'll hand him a phony name."
"Sorry, not possible."
A scratched phonograph record came to Pitt's mind. "Give me a phone or I'll do something nasty." She looked at him quizzically.
"Like what?"
"Go home," he said simply.
"Mr. Brogan's orders, you're not to leave the building until your flight to our camp in San Salvador. He'd have you in a straitjacket before you reach the front door."
Pitt hung back as they walked down a hallway. Then he suddenly turned and entered an anteroom whose door was unmarked. He calmly walked past a startled secretary and entered the inner office. A short man with cropped white hair, a cigarette dangling from his lips, and making strange markings on a graph, looked up in amused surprise. Pitt flashed his best politician smile and said,
"I beg your pardon, may I borrow your phone?"
"If you work here, you know that using an unauthorized phone is against agency regulations."
"Then I'm safe," said Pitt. "I don't work here."
"You'll never get an outside line," said old Whitehair.
"Watch me."
Pitt picked up the phone and asked the operator for Martin Brogan's office. In a few seconds, Brogan's private secretary came on the line.
"My name is Dirk Pitt. Please inform Mr. Brogan that if I don't get the use of a telephone in 1 minute, I'm going to cause a terrible scene."
"Who is this?"
"I told you."
Pitt was obstinate. Stoutly refusing to take no for an answer, it took him another 20 minutes of cursing, shouting, and generally being obnoxious before Brogan consented to a call outside the building. But only if Alice stood by and monitored the conversation. She showed him to a small private office and pointed to the phone.
"We have an internal operator standing by. Give her your number and she'll put it through."
Pitt spoke into the receiver.
"Operator, what's your name?"
"Jenny Murphy," replied a sexy voice.
"Jenny, let's start with Baltimore information. I'd like the number of Weehawken Marine Products."
"Just a sec. I'll get it for you."
Jenny got the number from the Baltimore information operator and placed the call. After explaining his problem to 4 different people, Pitt was finally connected to the executive chairman of the board, a title generally bestowed on old company heads who were eased out of the corporate mainstream.
"I'm Bob Condy. What can I do for you?"
Pitt looked at Alice and winked.
"Jack Farmer, Mr. Condy. I'm with the Federal Archaeological Survey, and I've discovered an old diving helmet in a shipwreck I hope you might identify."
"I'll do my best. My grandfather started the business nearly 80 years ago. We've kept fairly tight records."
"Have you got a serial number?"
"Yes, it was on a data plate attached to the front of the breastplate."
Pitt closed his eyes and visualized the helmet on the corpse inside the Cyclops. It read, "Weehawken Products Incorporated, Mark 5, serial number 5867C.
"The Navy Standard Diving Helmet," Condy said without hesitation. "We've been making them since 1916. Constructed of spun copper with bronze fittings. Has 4 sealed glass viewports.
"You sold it to the Navy?"
"Most of our orders came from the Navy. Still do, as a matter of fact. The Mark 5 Mod 1 is still popular for certain types of surface-supplied air diving operations. But this helmet was sold to a commercial customer."
"If you'll forgive me for asking, how do you know?"
"The serial number. 58 is the year it was manufactured. 67 is the number produced, and C stands for commercial sale. In other words, it was the 67th helmet to come out of our factory in 1958 and was sold to a commercial salvage company."
"Any chance of digging back and finding out who bought it?"
"Might take a good half hour.
We haven't bothered putting the old records on computer disks. I'd better call you back.
Alice shook her head. But the government can afford the phone service, Mr. Condi. I'll hang on the line.
Suit yourself.
Condi was as good as his word. He came back in 31 minutes.
Mr. Farmer, one of the bookkeepers found what you were looking for.
I'm ready.
The helmet, along with a diving suit and hose equipment, were sold to a private individual. Coincidentally, I knew him. Name was Hans Kronberg, a diver from the old school. Caught the bends more than anybody I ever knew. Hans was badly crippled, but it never stopped him from diving.
Do you know what became of him?
As I recall, he purchased the equipment for a salvage job somewhere around Cuba. Rumor was the bends finally put him away for good.
You don't remember who hired him?
No, it was too long ago, said Condi. I think he found himself a partner who had a few bucks. Hans's regular diving gear was old and worn. His suit must have had 50 patches on it. He worked hand to mouth, barely earned enough to make a decent living. Then, one day, he walks in here, buys all new equipment, and pays cash.
I appreciate your help, said Pitt.
Not at all. Glad you called. Interesting you should call. May I ask where you found this helmet?
Inside an old steel wreck near the Bahamas.
Condi got the picture. He was quiet for a moment.
Then he said,
So, old Hans never surfaced. Well, I guess he would have preferred it to passing away in bed.
Can you think of anyone else who might remember Hans?
Not really. All the hard-hat divers from the old days are gone now. The only lead I can think of is Hans's widow. She still sends me Christmas cards. She lives in a rest home.
Do you know the name of the rest home or where it's located?
I believe it's in Leesburg, Virginia. Haven't a clue to the name. Speaking of names, hers is Hilda.
Thank you, Mr. Condi. You've been a great help.
If you're ever in Baltimore, Mr. Farmer, drop in and say hello. Got plenty of time to talk about the old days since my son's aced me out of the company helm.
I'd like that, said Pitt. Goodbye.
Pitt cut the connection and rang Jenny Murphy. He asked her to call senior citizen rest homes around the Leesburg area until she hit on the one that housed Hilda Kronberg.
What are you after? Demanded Alice.
Pitt smiled.
I'm looking for El Dorado.
Very funny.
That's the trouble with CIA types, said Pitt. They can't take a joke.